Irreverent. Entertaining. Cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Marvin Smith, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and each Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, we will bring you answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. Now, today is a little different. Today, I'm coming to you from beautiful Toronto, Canada, and our topic is becoming aware, how to repattern your brain and revitalize your life. Now, to discuss this and more, our guest is Dr. John Kearney, a professor in the Department of Family Medicine at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. He is also a member of the Departments of Kinesiology and Psychiatry at McMaster and the author of Developmental Coordination Disorder and Its Consequences. Dr. Kearney's areas of research are related to child health and development and the role of physical activity in promoting health and well-being in children. He also studies research methods especially related to the development and testing of scales to measure things like child development, stress, and mental health. At the end of this show, if you'd like to learn more about this work, I strongly suggest you check out his website at www.inchlab.ca. Dr. Kearney, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Glad to have you. And one of the things, and I've spoken to a few people that I generally talk to before doing a show, and what I realized was there was not a lot of people that knew much about developmental coordination disorder. So if you could describe a little bit about your book and about the disorder itself and sort of provide us with an overview and an introduction to this particular problem.
Sure, I'd be happy to. First of all, I'm not surprised that it's not a widely familiar term, although probably people would recognize it or may recognize it by the many names that it's had over the history of the disorder. So we have referred to developmental coordination disorder, or DCD, as dyspraxia, ataxia, clumsy child syndrome. There's been a number of different names, and one of the reasons that we have tried to have a consensus on using a single term, because it's confusing, really, for clinicians, family members, and others, really, if we all use different terms to describe essentially the same thing. Let me describe what it is. The first and most important criteria for DCD is that these are children and adults who struggle with everyday fundamental movement skills. They can be related to gross motor skills, so things where we use our whole body, running, jumping activities, physical activities, sport participation. They can be related to balance, so having problems with both dynamic balance, so balance when you're moving, like if you were walking toe to heel on a straight line, we refer to that as dynamic balance. Or if you were standing still and holding one leg up and trying to hold your center of gravity or your center of balance, we would refer to that as static balance. And fine motor skills related to things like handwriting, putting a straw in a drinking box, tying shoelaces, buttoning shirts, doing up zippers. So these are children and adults who are really significantly behind where they should be, and in many cases can't do these basic skills. The other important criteria for DCD is that there isn't a pre-existing neurological condition that would explain why an individual is struggling with motor tasks. So, for example, if a person had a diagnosis of cerebral palsy, we wouldn't give a diagnosis of DCD or muscular dystrophy. And the final one is really important. It has to significantly and negatively impact their life in some way. And that usually for children is in relation to what we call everyday activities of living. So some of the things I mentioned, having problems dressing oneself. but also scholastic achievement or achievement at school. So when it starts to impact negatively school performance or quality of life in everyday living activities, then we would consider a diagnosis of DCD.
You know, when you were just mentioning in regards to the gross motor skills, and you mentioned the sort of heel to toe, I had this vision of, are there people who are getting pulled over? They're able to drive a car, but they get pulled over and they get out to do a sobriety test. And I can envision law enforcement thinking that somebody that has this is impaired or drunk. Is that mm-hmm. Is that an issue some people run into?
I've never heard of that. I think most law enforcement professionals would also be looking for signs of cognitive impairment, right? Slurring words or not being able to hold attention, and of course there's the more obvious signs of alcohol consumption, which is the smell of alcohol or liquor. But it is certainly true that somebody could look very much with balance problems like they were impaired in some way, whether it would be due to alcohol or drugs or something else. So it is a good analogy. I've never personally heard of adults with DCD being pulled over and or tested for roadside, but balance is a fundamental part of movement skills. It's required for a lot of things. So one of the things that we do commonly hear, both with children and adults, is especially when balance problems are present, is that they're accident prone. They tend to fall and injure themselves more easily, perhaps, than other individuals do, because balance is essential for walking up and down stairs, for example.
Yeah. Now, all of a sudden, I'm looking at an uncle of mine completely differently.
Well, I have to tell you, that happens quite frequently when I give talks. In fact, I would say more often than not, when I give a talk on DCD, or whether it's on the radio like this, or whether it's in a live situation, I'll describe the disorder. And the great thing about a live performance is I can show videos and other images and things to really illustrate the point. It's inevitable that somebody will come up to me afterwards and say that they'll either say that was me, or that was a very close friend, or a family member like an uncle or a child. I think that's what makes it so interesting. It is very common, or not uncommon at least. I would say quite common for a childhood disorder. Most people have had encounters with it. But they didn't necessarily see it as a neural developmental problem, and they didn't necessarily know, or even know at all, that there was a medical term for it.
Yeah, and I think it's nice sometimes if we can look at something a little differently. It may change the way in which we deal with that particular person. Now, in regards to that, and I know you talk about in your book, you talk about what some of the consequences are for these people. So what are the personal, social, physical, and mental health consequences of DCD?
Right. I should point out that the use of the word consequences was intended to be somewhat provocative. I have to say, in some instances, we're not 100% sure that it's really a consequence. It could be what we refer to in medicine as a concurrent or co-occurring problem. But what is certainly true is that DCD very rarely exists in isolation within a child or an adult. I keep saying adult because I have to say the vast majority of research that's been done in this area has been done on children, but there's growing interest on what happens to children with DCD as they get older, and so there's a really quite an emergent interest in the research line in adult DCD.
Yeah.
But returning to the point, one of the things that we see, and one of the things that I was particularly concerned about early on in my research, was would it be the case that a child with DCD, because of the motoric problems that they have, problems with balance, the things we mentioned, would they be less likely to play with other children and particularly engage in what we might call active play, which mm-hmm. could include sport-related activities and physical activity, but could also just include things like tag and what we refer to as free play activities. And if that persisted over time, what would be the social and physical results of not participating in those kinds of activities. And one of the things that we were particularly concerned about was whether or not these children were at increased risk for overweight, obesity, and some of the other consequences that are associated with physical inactivity. And our research basically supported that hypothesis, unfortunately.
Well, and I mean, it makes sense. I mean, you know, first of all, when you were mentioning in regards to it, you know, also in adults, well, all of us as adults were kids. If it was something that we were born with, we just may not have identified it, but it doesn't mean it's not still there. And when you talk about the inactivity, sure, I think that, you know, at any time in which, you know, you're on the school ground, if you go back to when you were a kid, or in my case, as also a room parent, you know, for my own kids, and I might have been a little bit more conscious of it because of what I do for a living, but seeing those kids when I would be on the playground with them and organizing them in a volleyball game or in a kickball game or whatever, and seeing that the kids that did not appear to be as athletic, and I didn't at the time think about what the reasoning was as to why, you know, they had a tendency to be more alone. They had a tendency to kind of wander out towards the fence, you know, and not necessarily to engage socially. And again, you know, because I've worked with at-risk youth for so long, you know, I found it to be my job to go out and see how I can get them involved.
Yes.
But not in any way thinking that there was something going on, that there was a particular, like a, as you say, like DCD. Not that. I more thought that if there's any way that I can help them socially to get them involved, that would have a you know, a benefit in the sense that if I can get them socially involved, they would choose to get more involved physically, and it would have that benefit. But again, I was looking at it from the other direction.
Well, and I think, you know, so my background is in psychology and social psychology, and you know, I study child development, as I'm sure you did as well, and an awful lot of emphasis in quite a lot of child development programs, particularly in the social sciences, is around cognitive, social, emotional development. And we tend, I think, sometimes when we see children who are not participating, not all professionals, and certainly I have colleagues who look at the world differently, and they've enriched my understanding and the way I look at children and child development. I'm referring to people like occupational therapists and physiotherapists and motor development people. But I think for a lot of us, we look at a child and we see a child not participating. We don't automatically assume that there's a physical basis to that. We think it may be motivational. Maybe the child lacks the competence or confidence to participate. Maybe they're shy. And of course, those things can be the reasons, and they need not be exclusive to DCD. I mean, we certainly see that with children with motor coordination difficulties. They quite rightly tend to rate their level of ability and their level of competence and confidence lower than children without those conditions. But I think what we need to think about when we see those children, and we do see those children all the time in the playground, in different community settings and other places, we need to consider the motoric issue and look at that, at least investigate it. And if there are some concerns there, then the research has been pretty consistent over time that if those motor concerns are not addressed, then the motivational, the affective, those other pieces, the confidence and competence, tend not to be impacted as well. To put it more bluntly, it's not a motivational problem if a child physically can't do the tasks that are required for those play situations. And assuming it's motivation and trying to motivate them often doesn't work if we don't try to accommodate the challenges that they have appropriately, matching what the child is capable of doing to what they're interested in doing. So I often say to my colleagues, part of the take-home message for this is that we need to think about motor just like we think about social development, emotional development, mental well-being. In fact, I have to say my perspective and take on these things is that we tend to separate them because it's easy to, especially for research purposes, it's easy if we separate things. But of course, these things are all related in childhood. And, you know, whether you go back to Piaget or even earlier, these are fundamental parts of a child's development. As we learn more about the brain, for example, in neurosciences, we learn that movement and the regions of the brain that we typically think of were associated with movement and motor control, like the cerebellum, also seem to be important for learning and emotional regulation. So, you know, we separate these things, but really we are embodied individuals, and all of these aspects are critical aspects of development.
Well, and it, you mentioned earlier about you know, at times, you know, like for instance, somebody with cerebral palsy that you wouldn't necessarily also add this, or you wouldn't see this. It seems like there would be great challenges in just identifying DCD or separating it. What are some of the challenges that you run into in trying to identify it or separate it from other other issues?
Well, you know, I have to say your question comes at a really great time, because I'm just about to begin to teach an undergraduate course in human growth and development, and I was working on my lecture slides for tomorrow's class. And you know, one of the main things we talk about in early human growth and development is what we call the incredible intra and inter-individual variability in development. So, for example, we usually think of 12 months of age as the age at which we typically see a child begin to walk. But really, the band around that is anywhere from 9 months to 18 months of age. In other words, children without neurodevelopmental disorders that would affect movement can walk at 9 months, or they can walk at 16 months. There's a lot of variability there. So one of the things that makes it quite difficult in relation to DCD is that we can't often identify atypical motor from typical motor development until the child is really past the age of 6. Because we see normal, quote-unquote normal, patterns of delay, or children who are slow to progress in certain domains. And we would hate to misattribute slow development to pathological or atypical development. And so it's really tricky. We don't often identify children with DCD until their school age, until the demands of the tasks that they have to do at school, like printing and writing, using scissors and things like that for art class, bring their difficulties, if they're fine motor difficulties, to light. When we are concerned about a child with DCD, or we're concerned that DCD is present, you really, really have to have the child assessed with what we call a standardized motor assessment. So that's a test of motor skill in all those areas that we've been talking about, and underlying motor ability, administered by somebody who is trained and can, like a psychometrist, a psychologist, or a kinesiologist, somebody who's trained in the administration of motor tests to really differentiate where children are. At the end of the day, DCD is, we might think of it as a statistical diagnosis, in the sense that it's not that they can't do some of the motor tasks that we've been talking about, but that the quality or accuracy of those motor skills is very low, which means it's on a continuum, like a curve, and they're at the very, very low end. So we really have, good tests that will assess and will be able to rank a child and where they are in terms of their motor development. And that's really the first piece, and it's a very critical piece in the diagnosis.
Now, what is there an age range in regards to screening for DCD in school-age children? Is there a general range, you know, that seems to be the best time to maybe screen for this?
Well, it's a fantastic question, and it's one that we still don't have a clear answer for. The tests that we have can be administered to children as young as 3 years of age. But as I said before, I would be very worried or very concerned about a diagnosis that early, because the child is still developing in motor skills and motor systems and systems of motor control. But in terms of studies and ongoing work, we currently have a longitudinal study where we are enrolling or screening children 4 and 5 years of age on motor assessment tests, and we are following them we should get an answer to the question, which is, what exactly is the number of children that you identify early who don't go on to show persistent motor coordination problems? Until we have that kind of data, it's going to be a little bit of hit and miss. So what people generally recommend in the field, and clinicians generally recommend in the field, is that you can do assessments on children in that preschool period, but you really would want to repeatedly assess them, follow them, and see if they're making progress. And if they aren't making progress, then the concern, obviously, is that you need to consider a diagnosis or consider some other diagnoses and intervention. So at the present time, we don't have an answer to that question, but we're working towards it.
Well, and while we're talking about it, the sort of early entry of this type of screening, we have an email question that came in, and I want to take this time to thank those people that take the time to email. I know that many people have to work, or with today being a holiday, it may be that they have plans with their family, aren't planning on being able to listen live. So sending in the questions is a great way for us to get the question asked, and then for those of you to listen later on through iTunes or Stitcher or whatever. So again, thank you for that. Now, this question reads, I am looking forward to the show. My son was diagnosed with ADHD when he entered school 2 years ago and was put on two medications. Mm-hmm. We have been frantically trying to deal with the resulting learning issues, as he does have some coordination and physical conditions that we believe are result of the meds. Our family doctor was not very knowledgeable about DCD when I called him about this after reading about your book this week, which, again, I think this came into us like on Friday, I think. Mm-hmm. So it says, you know, how do families get the help if their children are suffering with DCD? And it says, FYI, I'm buying your book today.
Thank you. And I hope it's helpful. And I would also say that the website that you made reference to earlier, inchlab.ca, we have a page there. We call it a resources page, and we have links to what we consider to be the best online resources for getting more information, which I think parents, usually parents more often than not, at least it gives them a place to begin and to begin to get information readily. And what's sifting through what's online, as you know, can be challenging. We've tried to identify the sites that we think have the most credible and most valuable information. So I would encourage people to go there as well. It's an interesting question. And one of the things that we sort of stopped when we were talking about consequences in terms of obesity and physical inactivity, one of the most common co-occurring neurodevelopmental problems with DCD is ADD and ADHD. So, in fact, in children with ADD and ADHD, about half of them, about 50%, also tend to have developmental coordination disorder. We've got quite a lot of epidemiological studies that have shown the rate is very high in that population. So I would hazard a guess, although I'm not a physician, I would hazard a guess that the motor coordination difficulties that are present are not necessarily due to the medication. In fact, I would suspect they're not. They are motor coordination difficulties that tend to co-occur with DCD. But regardless, it's extremely important that those motor coordination difficulties are properly addressed, as this parent, I'm sure, is aware of and concerned about, because we do see, again, from the research literature, that children who have both conditions, both ADHD and DCD, tend to have more trouble at school. Tend to be at greater risk for other kinds of adjustment problems as they get older. And it stands to reason, the attention or the inattention, difficulty sustaining attention, and sometimes the overflow hyperactive behaviors are troubling in their own right. But if you add that to motoric clumsiness, then in a lot of ways the child has a double jeopardy of concerns. I wish there were an easy fix for this. I wish there was an easy solution. What's very, very important, I think, is to do, as this parent has tried to do, you know, start with your family physician or your pediatrician, it's entirely acceptable to bring some information into those clinicians and talk specifically about your concerns with motor and ask for a referral to a developmental pediatrician or to a physiatrist or somebody else who can help and assist with the diagnosis. So there's lots of information out there that, again, you can find it through our website, and you can find it through a website. There's another great website called CanChild, CanChild.ca. We have a link on our site to the CanChild website. There's wonderful information there specifically for parents, and part of the information talks about how to discuss your concerns with motor with your family physician, your pediatrician. So I think that's a great place to start, because, you know, the other thing that we want to be very careful about here is that there are many potential causes of motor coordination difficulties, and some of them can be very, very serious. Underlying neurological trauma, you know, all kinds of things that one would want to have medical consultation to be sure is ruled out. But once you are assured that the diagnosis is DCD, or that's the most likely cause, I think there are two things that are really important. One is to get some physiotherapy or occupational therapeutic support. We have wonderful people who are highly, highly skilled at teaching children acquisition of motor skills and teaching them strategies to deal with the problems that they have. But the other part of it, from a parent's perspective, is a lot more challenging, mm-hmm. is learning how to advocate for your child and learning how to figure out how to create the optimal environments, whether it's in the home or the school or in recreational settings, for a child to participate. So I think it's important to recognize that a child with DCD, you know, may never be a downhill skier if you're up here in the northern right. part of the climate, or a water skier perhaps if you're down in the, or surfer. But they can participate in activities. They can swim, they can learn to swim, they can learn to ride a bike with the right kind of support and encouragement. And so an awful lot of dealing with DCD is managing the challenges and finding the right accommodations for children. So for finding the things that they can do really well and support and encourage them in those areas, and find out how to compensate, whether it's environmentally or whether it's through behavioral strategies or other things, for the things that they struggle with. So for example, printing. You know, printing and handwriting can be very, very difficult for some children with DCD. If it's acceptable and it's negotiated with the schools, learning how to use a typewriter or a keyboard instead of printing can be an effective strategy for children with DCD. That's an example of an accommodation that makes a huge difference to that child, because it's not that they don't have great ideas and want to communicate them. It's that they have difficulty printing and writing. You know, and I think that those are the kinds of things we have to separate. So there is right. information in the book, certainly, about strategies and what kinds of things work on an individual basis. But, you know, really, the prevalence of DCD, as far as our best estimates are, the best research we have, would suggest it's about 5% of the population. So it's a very common childhood condition. We're not going to be able to treat all of those children on an individual basis. So part of the, I have a colleague, Dr. Cheryl Mizuna at McMaster University, who's a leading expert, she's an occupational therapist by background, leading expert in DCD. She's working on bigger population-based strategies for accommodations and finding the right mix of teachers and health professionals and parents coming together to make a difference in the quality of life for children. So I wish there was an easy answer, but at the present time, that's really what we're left with. But it's knowledge is extremely important. So the first step is finding out as much as you can and then, you know, sharing that knowledge with others.
Right. And the information you've provided, I think, is so helpful in the sense that as a parent who doesn't understand, first understanding will help them, but then becoming more accommodating. And as you said, setting up situations that allow them to have greater self-esteem, meaning the child.
Yes.
The child now has greater self-esteem. Once you have greater self-esteem, you're halfway there because now they're more willing to try these other things and you keep them from shutting down. So I think your recommendations are right on target. But we're going to take a break real quick. We will be right back. And again, for everybody out there, stay with us. We're talking about developmental coordination disorder. You're listening to Answers for the Family. We'll be right back.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. We are talking with Dr. John Kearney, and the subject is DCD, Developmental Coordination Disorder. And John, if you could tell us a little bit about, I mean, how can we focus on repatterning the brain? You know, if we can repattern them to be able to approach this differently, what are the benefits that can come out of that?
It's you know, one of the things that we certainly are concerned about in early development is that if children are learning to do a motor skill inefficiently or incorrectly, you worry about the fact that you build neurosystems around the acquisition of those skills. It can often be very, very hard to correct it once those things come in place. But as you know, the brain is very plastic. So the wonderful thing about neuroplasticity is that it gives us the opportunity to do wonderful things even when there are limitations or problems that exist in neural circuitry that cause these kinds of problems in the first place. So, you know, I think it's really, really important that we investigate neuroscientifically what's happening in the brain with children with DCD. And that's been an area of research that's been somewhat slow to develop relative to other fields. But I have a colleague at the University of British Columbia, again in Canada, Jill Swicker, who has been doing neuroimaging studies of children with developmental coordination disorders, seeing if we can isolate regions of the brain that may be associated with some of the motor learning problems that children have. The early indications of that work show that, in fact, these tend not to be localized in any particular region of the brain. So I mentioned the cerebellum before. We've known for some time the cerebellum is really, really important. That's that lattice structure at the base of the brain. Most people have probably seen images of it. It's quite beautiful in its architecture. But that's the region of the brain that we typically associate with motor control, balance, those kinds of skills. And so a hypothesis for some time has been that there must be some kind of cerebellular disruption that's occurring that's affecting children with DCD. But her work has actually showed that when you look at the images of children with DCD and those without, executing the same motor task, and the kinds of tasks that she used are tracing tasks. So kids have to trace with a pen or a pencil between two lines and stay within the lines and follow the tracing task. The children with DCD, their brains look like, I tell my students, their brains look like a Christmas tree. All of the regions of their brain are firing. And they don't tend to learn. So what you see with children in a novel task is that might occur. You might see those same patterns in any child learning a novel motor task. But over time, as they learn how to do it, the regions of the brain become much more specialized, the ones where we see blood flow are much more specialized. We don't see that in children with DCD. And one of the concerns with that is it gives rise to this idea that children with DCD may fatigue quite a bit quicker, both physically and cognitively, because they are using so many resources to do the same tasks that most of us take for granted.
You know, when you just mentioned about having a lot of things firing at the same time, has there been any research? Is there any connection to Tourette's?
There is a connection to Tourette's. Of course, as you know, one of the symptoms of Tourette's can be motor-based tics, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it can be grimaces and things like that, which we think of as being motorically based. We don't see a lot. The prevalence of Tourette's is considerably lower than the prevalence of DCD, but it is something that we would see. We would see and can see clumsiness, for example, or motoric clumsiness, problems with motor ability and skill in children with Tourette's. So there's, you know, with all of these neurodevelopmental problems, there's considerable overlap, and that's why I said it earlier on that the use of the word consequences is somewhat provocative. I think, you know, when we're thinking about DCD inactivity and obesity, we can think about obesity and inactivity as consequences. But when we think about some of the other neurodevelopmental things that tend to co-occur with DCD, it's not clear that these are causal patterns or causal associations. It could very well be that there are common areas of the brain or common areas of circuitry that produce a number of different atypicalities across a number of different things, like Tourette's, ADHD, executive functioning, those kinds of things we see can cluster in children as having problems. It's a very old term in the research and clinical literature, which has started to make a comeback, and that's this notion of atypical brain development, that really what we're seeing in these kids is something has gone off course, if you will, in terms of their typical brain development, and it's producing a number of different things that manifest in behavioral problems, it could manifest in cognitive issues, it could manifest in motoric issues, and that we very rarely see children who have only one of these concerns. If you look and you assess properly, you'll often see that many of these things are present in a child. The more things that are present, the more concern we have with a child, because obviously there are more challenges there.
Now, what are some of the, you know, is there a positive side, you know, to where you can look at something, and I'm thinking of the fact when you mentioned about having a lot of things firing at the same time, that is also something, as you know, that they have with Tourette's, but at the same time, that also sometimes translates into someone who actually thinks, you know, 5 to 7 times faster than the average person because of the fact that they are used to having that many things firing at the same time. So is there that other side of this where it can be turned into something that makes them exceptional in another area?
Well, I think, you know, I'm not sure that I would be able to make a direct neurological link or a neurocognitive link, but what I can tell you is that one of the things we are quite concerned about children with DCD, in the studies we do, for example, we administer IQ assessments to all of our children, and if a child is scoring below 70, we typically wouldn't give that child a diagnosis of DCD, again, because there may be other issues that better explain their challenges with motor difficulties. But I digress a little bit. One of the things that we typically see with this population is that they often have quite high IQs,
yes,
to your point, particularly verbal IQ, which again is not terribly surprising if the motor is an issue and they're struggling in that domain. We see often kids can be quite gifted verbally. Now, that's not across the board. I'm not suggesting that all children with DCD are gifted or particularly bright verbally, but we certainly see that these are children who are in the typical range for IQ status, and we do see maybe 10 to 20% of these children who are quite high verbal ability, and I guess the general thing is we don't automatically assume because a child has DCD that they aren't capable or skilled or even highly skilled in other things, and often we see that they are. And one of the things that concerns us is that if they end up with a diagnosis that's not DCD, but that might be related to a learning, you know, might be perceived as being a learning disability or something else. Again, the comments you made before the break about the importance of self-esteem and confidence, that can be very damaging to a child. If you can imagine that, it's not a question of your knowledge or your creativity or your ability to reason. You simply are having problems with the functional task of writing or expressing yourself using that medium. We worry in some instances that certain kids could become quite frustrated and begin to believe that maybe they're not as bright as other children. And again, my colleague Cheryl Mizuna has a wonderful article. You can get it online. It's called "They're Bright, But They Can't Write." And the whole premise of that article is that we often misattribute or we label these children as having learning difficulties when in fact it's a functional issue with their ability to write. They're very intelligent, very creative, very expressive. They just need the right medium to express their ideas and communicate. So, I think the general theme of that's part of knowledge and accommodation and the things that we've been talking about is let's find what these children do really well and let's give them the opportunity to do those things and build that sense of competence, confidence, self-esteem.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I couldn't agree more. And it's one of the things, again, with some of the young people that we work with, it's amazing how many of them will start out with a statement like, you know, why bother? You probably think I'm stupid like everybody else. Or
yes,
why bother? You think I'm... And they immediately jump to a tag. And
one
of the things that I've taught my staff, because it was something that I started doing many years ago, was saying, actually, I don't know that at all. In fact, it's very possible that you could be superior. You're just now operating outside of this bubble that society wants to see people in. And I've just met you, so I don't know that you're not superior, you know, and we're just having trouble dealing with you. And all of a sudden, there's a look in their eye like, hey, I might talk to this guy because he hasn't labeled me, and it might be worth my time to listen.
You know, and one of the things that I often have to respond to is concern, you know, and I share the concern, I'm sure you do as well too, is this just another diagnosis, and what does the diagnosis mean, and are we over-diagnosing children, and you know, all of these sort of concerns that tend to circulate around childhood conditions because we're concerned about labeling and stigma and the other things that go with it. What we have observed, and I've certainly seen firsthand, and the research has supported it, is that there is a labeling process that goes on every single day. It's an informal labeling process, and oftentimes the labels that are used informally are far more damaging and hurtful than the ones that are used medically or in a professional setting. So, the kinds of things that kids with DCD tell us that they are told by their peers, sure, things like klutzy and clumsy and all those other things, but stupid, a moron, an idiot, and I won't use some of the other language on your on your radio program, very, very hurtful and damaging labels. Now, I don't expect, and I would be shocked if a teacher or a professional would use those kinds of languages, but you can communicate ideas without verbal, non-verbally, and if a child believes that people think that they're not as good as other children in the class, and they're different, and they don't have the same abilities, that can be very damaging. So when somebody asks me about the labeling and the stigma issue with DCD, I say, let's turn it around. Let's say all of a sudden you have a diagnosis or a name for the experience that you have been experiencing that's not a negative one, that opens up a world and an opportunity for awareness and education. that is a liberating moment. In and of itself, it's insufficient. You know, it only goes so far. Then you need real strategies to deal with the problem and real professional help and other things that go with it. But at least initially, there's always that aha moment. That makes so much sense. Now I understand, and I have a better understanding that this is something that needs special attention. And I think the informal negative labels or lack of awareness is far more damaging in the long run than the term DCD is, if it's used in the right way.
I completely agree. We have another email question or comment in this case. This one reads, as a family psychologist, I was excited to read about your book. I believe it is important for all of us in our field to understand how children are identified and treated who have DCD. One of my clients has a child that fits this description, and I am anxious to buy the book and share this information with them and others. Thank you for this great work. And this comes from Brendan H. in Washington.
Well, thank you very much, Brendan. And it's wonderful to see, you know, it's wonderful to see professionals and colleagues like ourselves in some ways, who have more training and experience perhaps in the behavioral sciences and psychology in particular, becoming aware of this problem. And you know, I think what it does is it opens up, as I said earlier, it opens up a new world for many of us who have typically operated in one paradigm or one frame, to think about these motoric challenges and how they affect other aspects of the child's development, and to recognize those problems as being just as important as the emotional and behavioral work that so much of us are immersed in our training. So it's very heartening to hear a clinical psychologist expressing the importance of DCD and taking it into consideration. That's wonderful.
Now, before we went on the air, you mentioned that you do some travels, and I believe it's for speaking. Do you have any events? What is coming up next? And are you out there speaking speaking to professionals to help raise the awareness on DCD?
Yeah, it's I try to do as much as I can. I'm first and foremost a professor, and so a lot of the conferences that we tend to go to, unfortunately, are often other professors. You know, that's one of the big challenges, I think, in academia, is that we spend an awful lot of time talking to one another, not enough time talking to a broader community. So I don't currently have anything slated for Southern California or anything on the West Coast at the moment. But we just had back in June, we had our, I believe it was the 11th international meeting of DCD. And it's been very interesting. I mean, I have to confess, I've been in the field in this particular area since 2003 is really when I became aware and started doing research. But some of my colleagues have been in it for much longer, and I think it always is very gratifying to them, and certainly to me, even in my short time in the field, to see the growth in number of researchers and clinicians who are coming out to these meetings, who are becoming aware, who are finding out information and learning about the condition and asking questions, good questions, about how best to manage the condition. What should we be doing? Are we looking in the right places? And it's very gratifying. It's very exciting. You can see the progress starting. You can see the momentum starting to build on it. I do as much community stuff as I can. I think most of it is local around here, Toronto. So if there's ever a place where I can be of service, Alan, let me know and I'll come out gladly.
I will certainly let you know. And again, for everybody else out there, be it a parent, a professional, if you want to learn more about this work, you can check out the website at, again, www.inchlab.ca. They've got lots of resources there. The book, I believe you can get anywhere, but I know if you go to, I think it's peregrinebookscompany.com, it'll definitely be there as well. Or, again, go to, if you're out there driving and you can't write any of this stuff down, go to our website, Answers for the Family, and we will have all of the information on how to get to these websites and to get more information either for your child or for your clients. John, thank you so much for coming on. I wish we had more time, but this is great. I look forward to talking to you again, and I'd love to know in the future where this is going, what the new technologies are, and how we can help more young people.
Yeah, we're learning all the time, and sometimes we're slow. And it's another criticism of my professional world. Sometimes we're not as fast as we need to be to get information out and take what we learn in research studies and translate that information so that it can have practical utility right away. Most people are frustrated, I think, with the research process. It can be quite slow, but there's wonderful people all over the world in different areas working on this. And the more we can stay connected and share information, the better. So yeah. I'm excited for the future, and I think thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to talk about this. As you said at the outset, it's not something widely known. So thank you for shining a light in this area.
Well, you're very welcome. And John, thank you so much. And for everybody out there, please tune in next week when our guest will be Elizabeth Galen Baker, and she'll be discussing her new book, Gifts of Gratitude, The Joyful Adventure of a Life Well Lived. And remember, if you miss a show or you want to share this show with your friends, just visit our archives at answersforthefamily.com. You can listen to this show or any others. And the next time you're on Facebook or Twitter, please remember to stop by our page and like us or tweet about us to others if you think that they can benefit from this show or any of our shows. Everybody, have a wonderful week, and be with us again next week on Answers for the Family.
Listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Marvin Smith, right here on LA Talk Radio.